Welcome to All Road 65 Max Radio, where the road ahead gets brighter as we journey towards truth, traveling through our dreams and an inspiration into a new reality. It's time, and your ticket is waiting. All Roads Lead 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson.
Greetings. Thank you for joining me on VBS Radio, All Road 65 Max. I am your host, Pamela L. Henderson. My focus is my mission statement, to help create a quality of life through social growth, inspiring jewels to become leaders by establishing partnerships with entrepreneurs, corporations, donors, sponsors, volunteers, the community, and abroad. Please join me every other Tuesday at noon on VBS Radio, All Roads 65 Max Radio. My special guest today is author Celia Riper, who shares her evident experiences based on real life struggles. Her novel, inspired by the challenging life of an author's grandmother, a woman who was left to raise her four children alone during the 1920s. Smooth flowing prose carries the lake forward at a steady pace. Farm and city vignettes create vivid images of time, place, and economic class. And Augusta emerges as a formidable woman in the face of daunting odds, a historically evocative period drama that's poignant and disquieting. At last, I want to say thanks again for giving me this interview chance, Ms. Riker, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So how are you doing today?
I am doing well. We're in Vermont and the weather's lovely. It's a little chilly in the mornings, but other than that, it's a lovely day today.
Absolutely. And that's what I always ask everyone who joins me sometimes, to tell me just a little bit about you growing up, and who are you? What made you become an author?
What made me become an author? Well, I was born in Detroit, and right now my husband and I are sharing our time between Vermont and Michigan. And the grandmother that I wrote about, Augusta, was born in Arkansas near the turn of the 20th century, and was abandoned by her second husband in 1920s Detroit. And that's what prompted me to write this book. It's been following me for a long time. When I began to actually work on this book, I found the notes that I had stashed away 30 years ago. And I had a list of people to interview, and all of them had passed away by then. So that was an eye-opener for me. But this is a story that's been following me. This grandmother affected me. She passed away when I was very young, and she taught me to appreciate a walk in the woods. And that's what my first book was about, a memoir about hiking Vermont's Long Trail. And she shows up in that book as well. When I'm resting at the top of Mount Baker and I see snakes sunning themselves, I remember that when my grandmother found out I was afraid of snakes, she taught me how to catch them and showed me how beautiful they were. Yeah, she didn't teach me how to bake muffins. She taught me how to catch snakes.
So, wow.
A little different than most grandmothers, but.
Yes, I am so afraid of snakes. I couldn't do it. Even the ones that they say that are friendly and don't have a venomous bite.
They can still bite you. Yes. I was still taught to be careful. They will still bite you. She taught me to appreciate a walk in the woods, and taught me not to be afraid of the sound of the loons on the lake, because when she found out I was afraid, she took me out onto the lake and showed me what was making that noise. So, she was a very proactive about fear. If I was afraid of something, we sat on the dock and watched storms roll in, so that she could show me what this is and what it looks like. And yeah, she had a little different way of looking at things. She took things head on, and partly because she had to, I guess, from the lifestyle she led. As a child, I had no idea how difficult her life had been. It seemed like a simple, wonderful life. in a little house near a lake. And I had no idea her life had been so difficult.
Right. Especially in the 1920s.
Yeah, and be married off at the age of 13 to the widowed father of one of her classmates. That was
yeah.
The image on the cover of the book is an image that my aunt, I had in my hand. It's a daguerreotype. I was holding it in my hand when my aunt reminded me that this was taken on her wedding day, and she was 13, and she's wearing her eighth grade graduation dress.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. So her life was very complicated and much more difficult than I ever imagined.
Wow. Yes. I want to get more into the book. In your book, you talk about the particular struggle that was common in the early 1900s, marriage at age 13. Tell me about the hardships. I mean, this is something that we're dealing with today. You know, from in different countries where young girls are being married off at age, what, 9 and 12. I mean, I have a granddaughter that age, and I just can't fathom that.
I tried to imagine when my aunt handed me that image, that daguerreotype, I thought, what would I have been like in eighth grade? Ooh, it just made me cringe. But she never talked about it. I never heard her complain. I never saw a picture of her first husband or her second, for that matter. There was quite a distance. Doing some research, I found out what it was like in the early 1800s on a hard knock farm in Arkansas, and her life would have been very difficult. There would have been no indoor plumbing. And most schools only went to eighth grade. So that was the end of her schooling anyway, whether she had money or not, there wasn't that option there. And the life would have been pretty difficult. They worked hard and didn't make much money. I don't know what took them to Detroit. I'm assuming work, because that's what brought a lot of people north. And when the car industry was roaring, a lot of people came to Detroit for jobs. And I'm assuming that's what her husband came for. And that's how I wrote it, because she never talked about these things. So I had to just base it on research that I did.
Okay. In your opinion, what would you consider to be the biggest challenge at the age of 13 for someone in your grandmother's position?
Biggest challenge? I don't know, the switch from being a child to being a wife. That'd be a big move. I don't know anything about it, but the man who was old enough to be her father, who became her husband, I had him sort of help her by, well, if you're 13 and someone says, oh, I love your gravy, and I think you're attractive. I mean, I wanted her to sort of fall for him, because I didn't want to think about the consequences if she hadn't. So I had him being nice to her, and that, a 13-year-old girl, it wouldn't take much to have her fall for you.
Yeah, that is so true. That is so true.
Especially if she didn't think she had many other choices.
Well, you know, if we look at in today's world, and we already complaining, like, you know, for me, especially what I do through my foundation, and I try to help girls, especially at a young age, it's 14, not to rush to be a woman. You know, let's enjoy life right now and do the girly things that a 14-year-old should be doing. And we have this discussion before that back in those times of the 1920s and 30s, and I think even in the 40s, it's just really, really heartfelt to know that a 13-year-old can get married or they start having kids.
Yes, it was, I'm sure that's part of the reason I'm sure that she didn't remarry quickly after the first marriage failed. And there was quite a few years between her first and second marriage, the end of her first marriage and her second marriage. And I'm sure it was because she'd made that decision. I'm not doing that again. But there weren't many other choices. She was a waitress, and waitresses didn't make much money then. Mm-hmm. And in the 20s, things were starting to go south, and there weren't that many, you know, they were approaching the Depression. And so that would have had a big effect also, which is why she ended up basically selling her youngest daughter. They were all going to end up in an orphanage if she didn't do something. And one of her regular customers at the restaurant, who always wanted to have children, basically bought her youngest daughter and helped provide money for her to take care of the other three. That's what it was. It wasn't a sale. It was much more of a deal, though, that if we could adopt this girl, then we would help you take care of the three you've got still. And I'm sure that was a pretty tough decision. Who would want to make that decision? I can lose all four, or I can let this person who seems like she'd be a good parent take on my youngest and my youngest daughter, and then go on. And that's what she did.
Wow, that's...
And like, ooh, I said, she never complained. I didn't know these stories until I was older and started asking questions. I didn't know how these things had happened. So, and much of it is fiction because I didn't know a lot. I researched and found out what it was like in Arkansas at the turn of the century, what it was like in Detroit in the 1920s. But I didn't have a lot of facts. I knew she was married at 13, and I knew certain dates, but I didn't know how she felt. And when I began to write this book, I thought I was going to write it in the omniscient third person, so I could tell the reader how Augusta felt when this happened, or tell the reader what her daughter Thelma or Yvonne thought when these things happened. But I found myself, the first scene I wrote it from her perspective, and I stayed in that perspective. I wrote it as if she were telling her story. And since I didn't know how she would have felt, I had to just guess how she would have felt. And I didn't know how people reacted, but I had to guess based on the research that I did. And there weren't a lot the building, the homes that she would have had an option to buy on, to live in as a poor person in Detroit, would have been shacks along the river, Detroit River. There weren't a lot of the kind of buildings you saw in Boston and Chicago and New York, the tenements. But I did put her in a tenement because there were a few in Detroit, and that's what I put her in, because I don't know what happened. I don't know where they lived. So I did some research into what the few tenements were like and put her there. The images that I saw, when I looked up tenements, I'd see this two-room apartment, dingy two-room apartment, and between the two rooms, there was a door and a window. Almost every time I got an image of the interior of one of the tenements, there was a two rooms with a door and a window in between the two. And I discovered that there had been legislation passed that required them to put windows in. So they just put a window in between the two rooms and called that a window. And then they passed another law that said that each apartment had to have one outside facing window. And they called them tuberculosis windows because that was supposed to help keep you from getting tuberculosis. But in my book, I wrote, I left the window and door in between the two rooms, and I added a tuberculosis window also to sort of tell my readers what it really was like. And the fact that they shared a joint restroom, or in many cases, they still had outside privies on these tenements. The one I put Augusta in did have a jointly used restroom on each floor. So, and it was far from inviting. You wouldn't want to rest in there for very long. So, and the bathtubs tended to sit on a pedestal next to the sink, next to the kitchen sink. There'd be a bathtub on a pedestal. And wow. I couldn't figure out what that was until I discovered that that was also the wash tub. And it was easier to wash the clothing if that tub was sitting on a pedestal. It made it awkward to get in and out if you actually wanted to take a bath. But these things I discovered that were a surprise to me. I had never looked into it that much. And the shacks that were along the Detroit River were evidently just that. Pieces of wood that they put together. Some of them were built out of pallets that the equipment came into the factories on, and they just take the pallets home and build a house out of it.
Wow.
And so these are things that I had never heard of. And these tenements were in relatively close proximity to normal neighborhoods. And I had that happen too, that they didn't have to walk far to be in a neighborhood where people were living in real houses and see how the other people were living there. I think I read that the reason there were so few tenements in Detroit is that Detroit didn't grow that much until the auto industry took off and the people were far more mobile. So they could get away from the city, and which is one of the reasons that there are fewer tenements in Detroit than there were in New York, Boston, Chicago.
Wow. So
it was a learning experience.
I bet.
How it had been for them was very different. I was told that a Polish woman helped my grandmother when her first marriage ended, and I created this Agata. I don't know what her name was. I don't know what she was like, but I created her in order to further the story. And I created another woman who was a little smarter. I had Agata live a life very much like Augustus in Poland. They had been poor farmers, but Edith was her father had been a professor in Poland. So I could introduce some of the other things that were going on that this woman knew more about than they did. Because to stick with the two of them, their life was very small. I mean, she worked and she took care of her family, and that's probably pretty close to all she did, because there was no money and there was no energy left. So.
Yeah, especially with four kids.
Yeah.
Yes. Back then, that was a lot. I am absolutely inspired how you stated that your grandmother was your hero. Tell me why.
Because when I was afraid of something, she taught me not to be. She showed me that it wasn't scary. Snakes aren't scary. The call of the loon isn't scary. And so, yeah, she made me a braver person than I would have been if she hadn't gone out there and made sure that I knew that this wasn't frightening. This was normal. Snakes are fine. They're just, look how, and she not only taught me that they were not scary, they were beautiful. Look at the scales and feel how soft their skin is. And I thought, whoa. So again, she didn't teach me how to make muffins, although she was a pretty good cook. I do remember she cooked on a little camp stove in her cottage was very small. And she cooked on what most people would call a camp stove. There were two burners. There was a tiny oven. And she had a hand pump at the kitchen sink, which I thought was very cool. She did have indoor plumbing, but to flush the toilet, you had to pump the water into a bucket and carry it in and pour it into the toilet. That was
close
to indoor plumbing as she had there. And I thought, as a child, I thought that was amazingly cool. It's so interesting. But she could make a dinner on that little stove. I do remember having very nice meals. And I don't know if this happened often or if I'm remembering it or if I'm remembering it being told to me, but she did love to fish. And quite on, and my, I may have heard this story enough times to think I actually remember it, but she would push herself away from the dinner table after having cooked this meal and say, "I don't know who's doing the dishes, but I cooked this meal and I'm going fishing." So we would clean up while she went fishing. So she did like to fish, but which was part of the reason for being near the lake. And it provided food too, I'm sure. So she was used to not having much.
I remember with my grandmother, I started off cooking at a very young age. I was 9. And I start peeling potatoes and putting water on the stove. And I mean, by the age of 12, I was a good cook. I was cooking gumbo, fried chicken, and everything. So I really appreciated my grandma and my mother.
Yeah, I think she may have taught me how to cook if she hadn't passed away when I was so young. I was only 6 when she passed away, and I do have these vivid memories of her and of her teaching me not to be afraid. And also in my book, I have a story where I caught a snake and took it in to show it to her. And she and my mother were in the kitchen, and I showed her the snake. This is different than the other snakes. And she took it out of my hands and then told me, "See this shape? This snake has a triangular shaped head. It's not round like the other snakes. And it has this dip in between its eyes. This is a pit viper. It's poisonous."
Ooh.
I brought in a, oh God, I can't even think of the kind of snake, copperhead.
Mm.
And she was very calm about it. My mother was gasping over here, but she was very calm about it. She said, "Why don't you take me to where you found this and we'll let him go." And so I took her across the street, which I wasn't allowed to go. And I got in trouble for having crossed the street. And I do remember waiting in her room for whatever punishment I was going to get. I don't remember what the punishment was, but I remember waiting. Because she was going to punish me for having lied. First of all, when she asked me where I found it, I told her I found it by the lake. And then when she found out, she knew I had gotten it across the street because the copperheads were in the stone wall across the street, not down by the lake. So I got in trouble for that. And I got in more trouble for telling the lie than I did for catching the snake. So that was the lesson.
Right.
Again, I don't remember the punishment, but I do remember waiting for it.
So grandma is the one that inspired you to write the book, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, her story followed me. I wished she had lived longer. I remember talking to my mother about the fact that I wish she had named me Augusta because I liked my grandmother so much. And she said, "You know, I did consider that, but I didn't know you were going to be a tomboy, but I did know that whether you were a tomboy or not, your nickname was going to be Gus. And I didn't want my daughter's name to be Gus." So when I was confirmed and I could pick a name, you get to pick your confirmation name, I chose Augusta.
I was looking at your book, and you have a copy of your book there. It is a very beautiful cover. How did you come up with that cover?
I did not come up with that cover. My publisher did most of the work on making this book look and become what it was. I actually did not like this cover.
No.
I complained about the cover because that image, I wanted it to just be that image of her. I didn't want the city of Detroit behind it. And I did not like the cover. And my brother-in-law, who is in photographic arts, said, you know, what's wrong with this cover? And he said, what's the first thing you see on this? I said, the lights from the I think that's the Standard Building. And I said, the lights from the Standard Building. And this isn't about the city of Detroit. And he said, where did the lights from that building take your eye? And I said, well, up to the name of the book, Augusta. And he said, and the color of that coincides with the color of the image of your grandmother. So it takes you to that image. I said, it takes you all around the page. He told me, he said, you should thank the guy who did this design. And that was done by Eddie Vincent. And he's wonderful. He just did another cover story, a cover image for my next book. And he said, you should just thank him and then be quiet because this is a great cover. And I've had a lot of comments like you did about the cover. It does represent the publisher told when I was telling them I wanted it to be her image. They said that if it's just her image, it's going to look like an autobiography, and it's right. Not an autobiography. Historic novels usually have the image of the person that's being written about and some idea of where they were. And on the back cover of this book is a cotton field, which would be indicative of her life in Arkansas. And so they were very good about getting everything into the cover that should be there.
Well, I'm glad you followed their opinion.
Yeah.
Because one thing like a book, like everything else, presentation is absolutely important.
And they knew a lot more about that than I did.
All you wanted was Grandma to be on the book.
I wanted her to be on the cover. I was surprised that the image that I have is 2.5 by 3.5 inches. So I was afraid they wouldn't be able to use it at all because it's so small, but it did enlarge fairly well.
Yeah, it did. It's nice. I like it. I want to get back into the book because it's very, very intriguing. And one of the things that you had mentioned about moving from a farm to the grinding, dirty, dangerous city and meeting new immigrants who had fled similar hardships in the 1900s. Tell me, how did she survive going through all of that? And that's what makes life so interesting, because that's overcoming adversity.
Right. And the bargain she made in order to keep her four children out of an orphanage is basically how she survived. They helped her keep her three children going, and they did raise Lottie, and they were kind and good to her. Her life was all right. The opening scene of the book is about her walking past the home of the family that had adopted her and wanting to just walking by to try to see her. And that story was told to me by my mother. And when her daughter started recognizing her as that woman who walks by so much, she tried to talk to her. And that's when she decided she couldn't go back anymore. And she didn't. And my mother told me this story many times. I imagined it happening in the fall. I imagined the family living on a corner because I didn't want to think of my grandmother walking through the alley to see her mother. To see her daughter, I mean. And so much of that was me fictionalizing where they lived. I have since learned that they lived upstairs over a business they owned. But I couldn't write. That's not what I remembered, because when my mother told me the story, I envisioned what happened. And for me to try to write them living upstairs over a business didn't work. It was not what I had been thinking about since I was very young. So I wrote the story that I remembered hearing.
Yeah, Okay. I had done research and getting back, because this is, again, thinking about this, and child marriages were common in the United States in the 1900s, with 11% of girls at age 15 to 19 marrying in 1910. And men were allowed to marry as young as 14 years old in the 1900s, up until 2017. And I did not know that.
I didn't know that either. I knew that it wasn't uncommon then for young people to marry. Again, there weren't many other choices. That's
it's just
and
I mean,
poverty left them with even fewer choices. So being a woman left her with fewer choices than the poor young men, but being a female made it even harder. Her choices were even fewer. So men had more choices in jobs in her case, as a poor woman, she could have been a maid, she could have been a waitress, she couldn't have been a nurse because she wouldn't have had the money to get the education. Anything that took any kind of training, like a secretary, she wouldn't have qualified for. So her choices would have been a maid or a nurse or a waitress, because there were just so few choices as a means to make a living. So not having much of an education limited them, and the poverty limited, and then add her being a female, and her choices were so few.
Yeah.
And I never heard her complain. I had some relatives who complained about everything, but my grandmother did not complain. I didn't hear her complain.
Yeah.
She just went about doing what she needed to do.
It's very alarming, because you got to think about, look what's going on in today's society right now.
Yeah.
We have teachers and, you know, dating very young men, you know, and I can't fathom that because I wasn't around that. But just doing the research had really woken me up. And it's like, oh my God, just in 2017, you know, it has, you know, it was then stated where they put laws in place. And for one, I always thought it was a law in place.
And
but
a lot of people probably did, but those who wanted to take advantage of that would have been able to. Yes,
yes.
I assumed that changed a long time ago. And I also assumed that, I found out that in my research that in Arkansas in the early 1900s, most children's education ended at the age of eight, or at the in the eighth grade, not the age of eight, but in the eighth grade. And in Detroit in the 1920s, most people's education ended in the eighth grade.
Yeah,
in the city
that's
of
true.
Detroit. I was surprised by that.
I remember my grandpa was telling me about that when I was like only, I was 12 or 13 years old. And he was from Louisiana, Monroe. And it just was amazing how life was for them then and how it is now. And if you really look at it, it's like, it seems like people trying to repeat itself from what went on in the older days in the 1900s and the 1800s, and bring that now into 2024. And
well, I hope that surprises you as much as it does me.
Yeah, you know.
I'm just shocked.
Yes. What is the most surprising thing you learned while writing your book?
Oh, good grief. The most surprising thing I learned. I think I already knew about her young marriage, and I think it had more to do with the things I researched, that finding out how difficult it had been, and how few choices people had.
That was
really an eye-opener for me. But one of the things that I found as I was writing this book, because I was writing it from her perspective, when I write, I often wander off, you know, and I'll sit down to write one thing. And when I push back and finish, I go, well, that's not where I thought I was going. And there were many times as I wrote this book that I didn't feel as if my mind had wandered. I felt as if I were channeling her. I felt as if I were being directed by her. Talk about this, about one of the things I bring up in the book, and it shows up a couple of times, is that life on the farm taught her to be tough because that's what it was. And, you know, when the mare had a foal that didn't live, they just took it and threw it in with the pigs because that's good food for the pigs.
Right. Eek.
And when her daughters are taken, her daughters at one point are taken out of the home. And one of them ends up in an orphanage. The other goes to the farm in Arkansas. And one of the things she's appalled by is that when a cow died, they just put it in with the pigs. And when she came back to be, you know, with her mother in Detroit, Thelma told her mother, "Oh, I couldn't believe it. Mama, your life was so hard." She had been picking cotton. Her hands were bloody from picking cotton. And the daughter who ended up in the orphanage in Columbus said she got the best deal. She got to go to school, which Thelma didn't get to go to school when she was helping her grandparents in Arkansas. And she said, "I got to go to school. I got 3 square meals a day. I had a much better life than Thelma had when she ended up on the farm." And I don't know why the two girls were split up, why one went to the farm in Arkansas and the other went to an orphanage in Columbus. But they were taken out of the home because of her second husband's drinking.
Okay.
And so when she reached a point after that husband, he just left. He just disappeared, never to be seen or heard from again. And after he left, and the social service people were letting her know that she could lose all 4 of her children. And she knew that her parents couldn't take them on. And she didn't know what orphanage would be like in different. She kind of got to choose the orphanage that that Yvonne went to. And but if she just lost them, she didn't know where they would end up. And so it was part that learning about that. Having had that happen already is part of what made her decide to allow her youngest daughter to be adopted by people that she was pretty sure would take good care of her daughter and would help her keep all the other 3 children. I mean, I can't imagine doing that with a puppy, let alone a daughter.
Yes, absolutely. So tell me about your book, Walking Home. You have another book that's out.
Yeah, Walking Home was my first book. At the age of 59, I decided that it was time to do some things. I was going to be officially old in a year. I thought 60 was going to be very old. And so I made a list of things I wanted to do. And one of them, when we started coming here to Vermont a lot, I learned about the Long Trail. It's a hiking trail that goes along the crest of the Green Mountains from the Massachusetts border to Canada. And I kept thinking I might want to do that. And on my 59th birthday, these two projects, hiking the Long Trail and writing a book, were on the top of my list of things that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I could write a book when I could no longer hike. So I hiked the Long Trail first. And the first book I wrote was about hiking from Massachusetts to Canada along the crest of the Green Mountains. And Augusta does show up in that book. When I hear the loons call, when I'm camping near the lake, when I see the snakes sunning themselves on Mount Baker, she does show up because she is a big part of my life. So
right.
She comes into several scenes in the book, in the first book. So, and I have another one coming out in June.
Oh, do you?
I've jumped genre. I went from the first book is a hiking memoir. The second book is a novel based on my grandmother's life. And my third book, called Big Guy.
Big Guy.
Big Guy is, see, I used to train horses for a living and teach horseback riding. And this is like Black Beauty. The story is told by the horse. And he's a show horse who's very talented and very arrogant. And when he can no longer win at the big shows because he's getting older and a little arthritic, he becomes a school horse used for giving lessons. And he thinks that is a huge step down. He's not going to be groomed to perfection every day. He's going to have hair sticking out of his ears. Ew. But his biggest challenge is that as a show horse, he was never turned out with other horses. He was so valuable that they only turned him out by himself. He had private paddock and he could see the school horses out in the field, but he hadn't been turned out with other horses since he was a baby. And his social skills are very poor. He says and does the wrong thing over and over again. And that is his big challenge. He doesn't know how to behave in social settings.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So you groomed horses for many years? Or
I gave riding lessons and trained horses for many years. That's how I met my husband. He was my veterinarian. And I got tired of paying the vet bills, so I decided to marry the vet.
That was a good move.
So that's how I met him. And 40 years, we are approaching our 40th anniversary. I can't believe it.
Wow.
I know.
Congratulations. Yes. Yeah, yes. Well, I'm not too far behind. I've been married for 25 years. So, yeah.
It's been good, and he's been very encouraging about this writing thing. I did not self-publish. I published with a hybrid publisher, but it still costs money to do this, and I haven't sold enough books to break even yet.
Yeah.
And my husband, who's very, very careful with money, has not squirmed at all about writing checks when they need to be written that I haven't made enough money to cover. And I told him one time that when I was deciding whether to publish a third book, I said, you're not going to get any of this money back. I haven't broken even yet. And he said, I'm not investing in your books. He said, I'm investing in the look on your face when you talk about it.
That's right.
And I thought, that's the guy. That's why I married that guy.
That's right. That's right. It's about the passion. And he sees that anytime you can put anything on paper and you can make a novel, a book out of it, that's very inspiring to others.
And doing it this late in life, I published my first book at 71. And at 74, I'm not done yet. I'm bringing out a third and working on a fourth, thinking about a fifth. Again, I don't see it making any money, but I do enjoy the process, and I do love hearing from people who have read my books and been touched by them. With my first book, I heard from a woman who hiked the long trail. She was in her 90s and she had hiked it back in the 30s, and she never got to finish it. She said, I didn't get to finish this trail until I read your book. And that touched me. I thought, oh,
that's right.
That's
very inspiring.
Yeah.
That was my next question, because I also had written a book, and I am in my first book. I'm on my second book now, but my first book, and I am a award-winning author as well, of the book called Journey of a Sapphire. And the book is about a girl who had overcame adversity on her journey towards success. And I hope to inspire others who are or who have gone through obstacles and challenges to never give up on your dreams and aspirations, and how to recognize, most importantly, the behavioral problems, because that is something that we go through on our journey each year as we get older, of the challenges and obstacles. So my question to you, what message do you want the reader to know?
The message, each book has my first book's message was, because it took me so long to complete the hike that I thought was going to happen pretty quickly, to just keep going, just put your head down and keep going. And having finished that, I felt so good. There were times when I didn't think I was going to be able to complete the hike. It took longer than I ever dreamt it would. And on the second book, it's a similar message, and that is to keep going. I mean, my Augusta didn't just survive, she thrived.
Right.
There were things that she had to do that she, of course, didn't want to do, but she made that work for her, and she raised her children. They went on and had happy families, and my father was Buddy in this book. And he was raised, what he learned from his father, I think, was not to drink and not to swear. In the book, Buddy swears like a little mule skinner. I didn't know that until my aunt told me that when she came home from the orphanage, she walked around behind him with her hand out and smacked him in the head every time he swore. And as an adult, he didn't swear. I didn't hear my father swear until I was in high school. And he didn't drink much at all. And I think he learned what not to do.
Okay. We all have a story. And I knew when I had visioned my company, I tattooed my ankle, the logo of my company on my ankle. And the reason why is because it's all about dreams and aspirations. And I'm such an empath as well. So I take everything to heart. And me, on this journey, when you're overcoming adversity, that the dreams and aspirations are essential towards social growth. As you know, if you were to get a tattoo, this is my $100 question. If you were to get a tattoo, what would it say, or what would the graphic be about?
Wow. I think it would be a loon. I love loons. If I see a picture of a loon, because I was afraid of them, and because my grandmother taught me what they were and that there was nothing at all to fear, I have images of loons around, because it's just one of the things. I thought the first thing I thought of was snake, but I thought, oh no, I wouldn't want to put a snake on me. But that she taught me not to be afraid of them, not to be afraid. Yeah, the loon. I love the call of a loon. And
yeah.
When I was a child, it frightened me. I used to sleep on her porch and I'd hear it and I'd think, I don't know if you've heard loon calls, but they're kind of eerie sounding. And she took me out in a rowboat just about sunset and showed them to me. And that is in the first book. That scene is in the first book, of her teaching me not to be afraid of the loons. I just not too long ago, I bought an image. It's a framed turkey feather, and there's a loon at sunset on a pond at sunset, painted on this turkey feather, and then it's framed. So I had to buy that.
Right. In your opinion, what makes a great book? What makes a great story?
A great story. What makes a great story is to write something that will touch someone. And so different stories are going to touch different people. I might read a story that doesn't quite touch me the way it would touch you or my husband. We're both avid readers. And sometimes I'll read a book and say, oh, you're going to love this. And then he doesn't. And I've learned what books to tell him to avoid. I love this. You're going to hate it. Don't read this book. So yeah, touching someone, and it in different books are going to touch different people. And so most of the time, Don and I agree on a book. If he likes it, I'll like it. But every once in a while, I'll do one that just hit me, and he doesn't see it at all.
Right?
Yeah. And making it well, having it be well written is helpful. I've read some books that I thought, this is a great story, but it's not very well told. And it needs to be a good story well told. And I went through a lot of, both of my books were much longer when I finished them than they were when I published them, because I had to get them down to the meat of, especially the first book. It was way too long.
And really?
Miles too long. And working with a writer's group is very helpful. And I do work with a writer's group, and they are very helpful. We'll write scenes, and then I'll write a scene and submit it. And there's usually five of us in the group, and we'll have different scenes. I'll read theirs, they'll read mine. And we talk about what works and what doesn't work. And it's very helpful to have other authors sharing their work. I quite often learn as much from what they're doing as I do from what they're saying about what I'm doing, because I'll see something in theirs and go, yeah, we don't need to have that there. I belong to the League of Vermont Writers, and writers group, that is a different writers group than the group I write with. And they're always working on reading about craft, talking about craft. What makes this sentence better than that sentence? The book that they're working on now with the League of Vermont Writers is called How to Write a Sentence. And I thought, well, that seems pretty basic, but it's a really good book, because the difference between saying this and saying that, and for instance, she went to the window, and looking down into the garden, she saw a cat cowering under the garden bench.
Mm-hmm.
She went to the window. I don't need to tell you that she looked down, because I already told her she went to the window. She went to the window. A cat cowered under the garden bench. You've eliminated a half a dozen words and told the same story much quicker. That's one of the things that good writers do, is tell the story in as few words as possible. One of the revisions when I'm revising, I'm often shortening. Rarely do I add things. But, and I did write for a newspaper for a while, and I had a prescribed word count. And I never paid any attention to word count with my first iteration, and then go back and winnow it down to the word count. Because the first version of everything is not going to be the finished work.
Yeah, that is so true.
When I read Stephen King's book on writing, he said that Kurt Vonnegut doesn't revise the way I revise. He seems to write it the way it's going to be the first time. And that impressed him. I don't know if that's actually true, but I don't know how that would even be possible. But I need to get it on the page first and then go back and clean it up.
Yeah, me too. That's what I do too. So true. So true. That was my next question. What was your favorite four books to read?
Favorite four books to read. Wow. As a kid, I loved The Call of the Wild. And mm-hmm. when I walked around in the winter, I would imagine myself in that book. yeah. I'd be walking along and thinking about that book. And that's what I would do as a kid. I'd read a book and think about it. And Black Beauty was one of my favorites. Hobby Horse Hill as a kid, I loved. But Black Beauty was written from the viewpoint of the horse, and I liked that. And that's what inspired me to write Big Guy from the viewpoint of the horse. There's so many, it's hard to pick one.
I know, huh? I like a lot of love novels, books about love, the journey. I do. I can't, like, even today, like when we have family night and we end up even watching a movie, and my grandson, they tend to like to watch a lot of scary type movies with a lot of blood, and then they kind of tease me. They say, "Oh, you're a little boring. I always want to watch a love story." Yeah, because,
well, so even if it's not a quote love story, books mm-hmm. that have love in them, I think that's part of what touches people.
Right.
When I read On Golden Pond, I was touched by that book so much that I did not want to see the movie because I didn't want to ruin the book. Fortunately, the movie wasn't a disappointment. I did finally see it, but I avoided seeing it because I didn't want how I felt about the book to be affected by a movie that wasn't up to par. But it did. And that is about love too, a different kind of love. The two parents loved one another, obviously, and the love between the father and daughter that was strained, but it was still there. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to tell a love story.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, I'm just going to throw this out here because there's so much going on. We're dealing with so much chaos and we have war. I mean, it's really disheartening, but one thing that I do, and I am so inspired from humanity, is that we are crying out and we're sticking together to let things that are not good be aware that we have had enough. And I am girl empowerment, and I just love the women that I see out here raising their voices and everything. So for the next couple of months, I am celebrating International Women's Month globally, celebrating girl empowerment and change for humanity, because evil disguises itself as good and excellence, and every culture needs cleansing. And I hope and pray for continuance to share. Everyone, share your stories, and let's get together and navigate towards healing from the injustice and trauma. But most importantly, we have to trust the process. Because I feel right now when people say, "Oh, it's the end of the world." No, I don't believe in that. But what I do believe, there's a cleansing that is happening. And that is what the world itself is going through. So, Ms. Riker, how can someone contact you to purchase your books?
Well, my books are available wherever books are sold. Any bookstore can order them for you. But my website is celiariker.com, and you can contact me through that. And my email address is celia@celiariker.com. And the spelling is different. So it's right there under my image there. And when you go to look for me, the R-Y-K-E-R is actually a Dutch spelling. But yes, that's how to find me. And you can find me through Rootstock Publishing too. They helped me do all of this. When I published my first book, I had been online. I had a email address. I didn't have a website. I'd never been on Facebook or Instagram or any of that. And my publisher helped me do all of that. And I got my name, celiariker.com, as my domain name. I didn't even know what a domain name was. But they helped me do all of this in my old age. I'm doing all kinds of new things.
That's right. And
you're
it's
not very exciting.
You're not old until you're way past 100. When you, to me, we could say that we're old, but you're still vibrant. You're still doing things that others aren't doing, even at a young age. Is there anything else you would like the world to know?
Well, about age, yeah, just keep going. Just, I'm going to do as much as I can for as long as I can, and try to be reasonable about it. You can't, we can't act like we're teenagers, but
true.
I have a lot of people who watch me walking on a trail and say, "I can't believe that you're hiking like that when you're in your 70s? And I said, well, I've hiked with people who are in their 80s, and I've heard about people hiking in their 90s. So
yeah,
I love to walk in the woods. So let's go.
Yeah. Well, with that being said, we are up for time. Ms. Riker, it has been a pleasure having you on my show. And I did ask you, did you have any last minute questions? Well, readers, I have reached my destination, and I leave you with this quote. Until next time, do have a fabulous day. From a true sapphire herself, Pamela L. Henderson. And the quote is, the act of facing overwhelming odds produces greatness and beauty. Until next time, cheers.
Thank you for listening to All Roads 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson. Join us every other week on Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on BBS Radio Station 1. And please visit allroads65max.org and become a volunteer or sponsor and be the change you want to see in this world. With your help, we can make a difference in our society and uplift those who so desperately need our help. Thank you for tuning in.